Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, or Erev Tov in Israel. Welcome to part three. After we took a break last week, of course, Erev Tisha B'Av, Rabbi Blau's series on Halacha and Agadah. And today, I think the discussion is the relationship between Halacha and Agadah. There's a lot to discuss in Agadah, so we look forward. Avakasha, Rabbi Blau.
Okay, thank you very much, Rav Jay. It's exciting to be back after a two-week break, a one-week break. So I just want to clarify, this is going to be a little different than something we discussed last week. Last week, we were curious about the placement of Haggadah. Let's say an Haggadah is adjacent to a different story or adjacent to a halachic discussion. Could the story somehow impact on the adjacent sugya? We're not discussing that today. Maybe there's an Haggadah that stands alone. We're not curious how it relates to something previous. But there's a detail. There's a legal detail in the story. So could we use that to derive halachot? So I will try, I'll just throw out one example to give you a sense of what I'm saying, and we'll try to figure out what the logic would be. Why should we or why should we not? So here's a good example. We'll again go to a famous story. We've already used the Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave story multiple times. We discussed the symbolism of the Hadas branches. We discussed the placement of the sugya. But I want to talk about a halachic detail that's kind of snuck in. I'm curious if anyone remembers this. They only have one set of clothes, apparently. And they're going to be there for a long time. So they don't want their clothes to wear away. So most of the day, they don't wear them, right? That'll shut down. And they don't want to be naked, of course. So it says that they're sitting in sand. Okay. And then they put on their clothes. But what's very interesting is, what do they put on their clothes for? They put on their clothes for davening. Meaning, it sounds like, oh, they're discussing a great sugya in Masechet Pesachim. Who needs clothes? We'll sit in sand and that's good enough. Ah, but we're going to daven mincha, time to put on a shirt and pants. So again, you could say, no, you're doing it, you're barking up the wrong tree. This is a Haggadic story. It's not about the principles of Jewish law. Like, why are you trying to derive halachot from there? Or one could say, what are you talking about? Clearly implicit in this story is actually a really interesting halacha. What is implicit in this story, perhaps? And I think this is true halachically, that the mode of dress one needs for Shmona Esrei for tefillah is more serious than for davening. For Talmud Torah. Like, perhaps the halacha is that as long as my private parts are covered, I know it's not so respectable, but I could, you know, open a rashba when I'm bare-chested. Let's say I know I'm bare-chested for a reason, and I quickly want to look up a rashba. So I open it up, but maybe that would not at all be appropriate for davening mincha. If I'm standing before God, no, I need to have clothes on. So if that's true, someone would say, but the close reader of this Talmudic tale will also get some halacha. That's why Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his son had a different behavior for davening and for Torah. So that's the kind of thing we're asking. Again, we're not saying how does it relate to a connected sugya, just halachic details in a story, can they be very telling in terms of working out the principles of Jewish law? Okay, great. With that in mind, let us go to the source sheet. I want to say again, I'm going to put the source sheet on the screen, although I think a lot of you have access to it, but please feel free to write in the chat if you have a comment or a question, and I will at some point take a look. Okay, here we go. Let's take the share screen. Okay, here we go. So we're going to start with an operative statement, and the operative statement is going to seem really strong. But let's see, we have to be careful. I say this to people in life. Like, sometimes people quote one source from Chazal and that like ends the conversation. And I'll often point out, you know, Chazal were pretty complicated and pretty varied. So if you want to discuss a topic in depth, probably one source is not going to do it. But nonetheless, let's start with this source. So this, it's interesting. It's not in the Bavli, it's in the Yerushalmi. And it says, Rabbi Zeir b'Shem Shmuel says, Ein l'meidim lo min halachot, the lo min ha-gadot. Now, let's be careful, because we tend to use the word agada with an aleph, but Chazal sometimes use the word hagada for the same thing. Okay, so don't learn from the agada. The lo min ha-tosfot. Now, here also we have to be a little bit historical, right? Obviously, the medieval scholars of France and Germany who wrote the Tosfot, they are not being discussed in Yerushalmi. So let us say that Tosfot here means what's called the Tosefta. Now, just to clarify, this is good general knowledge. Tannaitic sources can be divided between the Mishnah, the Tosefta, and a Braita. A Mishnah, of course, is our famous Mishnaic collection. The Tosefta is an additional collection, right? Even if you think about the word, why is it called the Tosefta? Well, the Tosefta is an additional collection. Like, you know, when I love this, when I teach Torah, I like to teach my students how to order food in Israeli restaurants. There's like a side benefit. So if I'm in the pizza store and they ask me what Tosefot do I want, right? They're asking me like what toppings, right? Something additional is a Tosefot. So it sounds like don't derive halacha from Agadah or from the Tosefta. Ela min ha-Talmud. Okay, where am I supposed to get it from? Open that Talmud Bavli. That's where it's at. That or the Talmud Yerushalmi. That's where I get halacha from. So if I just have this source, it sounds like, whoa, it's all over. I am not meant to derive halacha from Agadic sources. That's lo min ha-Hagadot. And the real source of halacha is the Talmud Bavli. Now, I want to point out already, there's something in this source to make us a little suspicious of that reading. Okay, notice what else was listed. I'm even ignoring the first phrase. I don't want to get into that right now. But even let's deal with the third phrase. Wait, is it really true I can't get any halacha from the Tosefta? Right? Don't forget, Agadah is often stories. It's often narrative. It doesn't seem like halachic material. Tosefta seems just as halachic as the Mishnah. That's what it is. It's a book of halachot. Now, granted, maybe because it's not in the Mishnah, maybe it doesn't have the same status as the Mishnah, but I think, let's think about the following scenario. Okay, we'll get back to this later. What if there's halacha that's never mentioned in the Mishnah, but it is covered in the Tosefta? Would we say that's not the din? I think the normal would be, okay, if it's not in the Mishnah at all, the Tosefta is a reasonable second place to look to find out what the halacha is. So again, in terms of our opening statement, I would be careful because it does sound like you could just take it very literally and say, Agadah cannot affect the halachic system. But again, don't forget that Agadah is lined up together with Tosefta in this list. Okay? So that is the main source. Now, let's try to figure out, because I think one could say a lot of different things. Let's try to figure out why this would be. Like, why is it that we shouldn't learn halacha from the Agadah? So actually, I'm going to go a little bit out of order because I decided I want to do this a little bit. We're going to look at it, explore like three or four possibilities. But maybe we'll go a little bit out of order to an interesting Gemara in Megillah. Okay? Because I think this might be the first possibility that we should look at. Okay, here we go. Now, as usual, I have the Gemaras in English as well. So we will look at this Gemara in English. Now, we're going to have to go with the Chazal's Agadic imagination here. So I know that probably a lot of you really like Megillat Esther. It is a wonderful sefer. I know that if one reads Megillat Esther just according to the pshat, Mordechai and Esther were certainly not married. I agree. But let's go with Chazal for a second. Chazal have the suggestion that Mordechai and Esther were married. Okay, so let's see source 7. Okay, so says Esther, go gather together all the Jews, which is not according to the custom, right? The phrase, the big phrase in Megillat Esther, lo kedat. Now, what is happening lo kedat here? Rabbi Abba said, it will not be according to the custom every other day. Till now, I've associated with Achashverosh under compulsion. But now I will do so of my own will. Says Esther, wait, Mordechai, you're asking me to do a drastic change. I never wanted to be together with the Sfel Achashverosh in the bedroom. I just had to do it because I had no choice. But now I'm initiating it. I am going to him. That is a break in the custom. But not only that, says Esther, according to this Agadah, and we can all agree, right? This is not a halachic Gemara. There's a Agadic section in Masechet Megillah. She says, Kasher avadati avadati. What does that mean according to Megillah? If I perish, I perish. As I'm lost to my father's house, so I should be lost to you. Now, this is pretty amazing Gemara, right? If, unfortunately, a woman willingly has an affair, so there's a famous Isur that's created, she can cannot no longer be with either the fellow she's had the affair with or with her husband. So Esther seems to be claiming, according to this, this is a disaster. Till now, I was doing it under compulsion and there was no prohibition created between me and you, Mordechai, my husband, my real husband. But now that I'm willingly going, there's going to be a prohibition. Okay? That's the Gemara. Again, I don't want to get into a long discussion with Megillat Esther about whether they're really married or not. In the pshat, they're not married, but fine. But let's just take it and run with it. So Tosfot says, wait, I don't understand. Now, this is very interesting because we said that Tosfot were halachic men. Look how legally Tosfot takes it. Tosfot is treating this like it's a sugya in Masechet Kiddushin. Look at Tosfot. Says Tosfot, wait, v'im tomar amai loya magarsha, Vitimer lachzirena. He says, I have a simple solution. Let Mordechai divorce Esther, and then she's just a single woman being with Achashverosh. She's not a married woman. And it's, please God, one day she'll get out of the palace and he can remarry her. No reason why not. So Tosfot is thinking very legally and is trying to figure out, what's the big deal? I've got a great solution. This should not be a case of an affair of adultery. This should just be, just divorce her now and you'll solve the problem later. Okay, now Tosfot, again, the whole way Tosfot is going with assumption, this is legally relevant. Because even look at Tosfot's answer. Yesh lomar l'fishako masa get hu al pi edim. Wait, you don't just write a document of divorce, a bill of divorce. Witnesses sign it. Once witnesses sign it, there's a certain amount of publicity to it. And they're living in great fear. You know, Achashverosh finds out that Esther's married to Mordechai. Next thing you know, Mordechai's dead. So again, like we all agree, I'm not saying this to make fun of Tosfot. Just realize Tosfot is fully in the legal universe. Why can't they solve with a divorce? No, it won't work practically because word will get out. Okay, now let us go to the Rashba, a different Rishon in source 9. He first quotes Tosfot, and it's very interesting because he totally starts in the legal universe and then he breaks free. Okay, so he says, here we go. I'm just going to highlight where we are. He says, "Ve'eno nachon be'enai." I don't like Tosfot's answer. And again, he's still in the legal universe at this point. Why? "Ve'yichtov lo b'ktav yado shu kasher d'oraita." Now, I don't get into details at all. Some of you are probably familiar with this, but there's a way to do a get without witnesses. Meaning, if it's not the scribe who wrote it up, it's the husband who wrote it up, without getting into why, you could render their need for witnesses irrelevant. So again, we're still in the world of halacha here. Says the Rashba, I could surmount that problem. If the only issue is that it'll get out because they're witnesses, I've figured out a way to do it halachically. But let's go here. Look at the last line. I think everyone's going to be happy with this, or not everybody. Some people will be happy with this. Says the Rashba, the loite and Esther leMordechai. If we did that, it would not create an Isser. So why are Mordechai and Esther in trouble? Ella shedivrei agadahin ve'ein meshivin alein. So notice the Rashba does the end. This agadah, maybe this is the wrong conversation. Now, what I would say is every text has a purpose. So what if your purpose is some kind of moral exhortation? Your purpose is some kind of religious theme. It's not about the nitty gritty of halachic details. So you might not even, I know some of you might not like this, but I'm not sure you'd even be so zealous about getting a halachic detail right. Because that's not what it's about. What if this Gemara wants to convey, for whatever reason, the Gemara is convinced that Mordechai and Esther are married, and it wants to convey the tragedy of Esther having to be with Achashverosh. So from that perspective, the best way for the Gemara to convey that tragedy is to say, wait, if she's willingly going, they're going to be hostile to each other. That really captures, right, the awfulness of Esther having to go be with Achashverosh. What if you tell me that we could have done a get, and we could have done it a particular way, that there won't be Edom? That's not relevant. That's not the conversation the Gemara is having right now. Okay, we're good? I see a couple of chat questions to look at in 1 second, but I'm going to call this category one. What is category one? Or perhaps rationale number one. We're not going to derive halacha from Agadah because it's a category mistake. It's a category mistake in terms of what the Gemara is trying to accomplish. The Gemara wants to convey an agadic theme. It is not so concerned with the precision of the halachic details. Okay, I'm looking at the chat for 1 second. Okay, there's some interesting questions here, but I'm going to duck it for now. I see we have some, Alana Lubin is a knowledgeable woman. Okay, but we're not going to get into your question right now, Alana, if that's okay. Okay, Alana, there's a certain irony here, because if I got into your question, I'd be back in the Tosfos universe, right? I'd be dealing with every detail of the legal universe. But I'm going to go with the Rashba for now. Okay, which is that this is not meant to be dealt with on that halachic plane. Okay, terrific. Okay, let's go back to the beginning. And I want to contrast this with some other reasons, perhaps why. Okay, so we're back in source 2. Okay, this is introduction to Gemara by a fellow named Rav Shmuel HaNugget. He's quite early, actually. He's before the Rishonim, like before Rashi and Tosfot. And there was a period, as you know, I'm giving this year because I love Agadah, but I need to admit that there was a position in the times of the Gaonim that kind of downplayed Agadah altogether. Okay, look what he says here. The Haggadah, again, using the word Haggadah for Agadah, what we would call Agadah, So it's not halachic. It's not about a mitzvah. The ein lecha lilmud mimena, and don't learn from it, elamashi yala al hadat, unless it's really reasonable. And then he says, v'yeshcha ledat shekol ma shekimu chazal halacha binyan mitzvah, shumi pi Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom. So what's he saying? He's saying that in general, halacha has a more authoritative status than agada. There's a sense in Shmuel Anagid, in Rav Shmuel Anagid, that halacha is based on a synodic tradition. It is much more well-rooted. Where agada, again, not to say it's meaningless, but, you know, smart rabbis tried to convey ideas and they did the best they could, but it will not have the same authoritative status as halacha. Now, notice what's happening here, though. It's very, very different than the Rashba. I would say that according to the Rashba, we're not downplaying the status of agada in the slightest. When I say something has a different purpose, I'm not saying it's a lower level. It just has a different purpose. That's all I'm saying. I think Rav Shmuel Anagid is saying something more radical, that halacha, the halachic text, that is more rooted in our tradition, in an old tradition, than agadic statements are. And I think the Gaonim found this easier, by the way, because one of the things we're not going to discuss in the series, maybe I'll merit to teach again in Torah Motion one day, we're not going to discuss difficult agadot, but one of the ways going to my deal with it is that, okay, it's a difficult, let's say it's an agadot you think is really, you know, outlandish, right? So obviously one approach is to interpret it metaphorically. That's often what people do. Okay, but another approach might be to say, look, agadot does not have the same status as halakha. It's less of a crisis if we're having trouble accepting an agada. Okay, so we got reason two down. So I would say we've got this big contrast here between the Rashba saying, that's just not what the story's about. Stories are not, they're about conveying ideas. They're not about halachic detail. Whereas in the world of Rav Shmuel HaNagid, we're really downplaying the power and force of agadot per se. Okay, let us look at one more. We'll try one more approach. Okay. That's the way I see someone's really getting into. Okay. All right. Those of you, right, guys, after this year, Rav Jay will give a halachic shir on the Esther.
I'm sorry. Just you contribute on the Agada, and if anybody.
Okay, fine. That's it. We got a good split. Sometimes you solve these problems by having your Agada command, your halachic man. So yeah. Rav Jay is going to be my halachic man for this, and I'm just going to stick with the Agada.
Okay. Good.
Okay, here we go. So I'm going to toss out a third possibility, which it's not really in the commentaries about Agadah, but it seems to me it might be similar. Okay, let's look at this Gemara in Bava Batra, because it's really about a different kind of thinker. You'll see what I mean in one second. Okay, here again, we have the English in source three. Our rabbis taught the halakha may not be derived either from theoretical or from a practical decision until one has been told that the halacha is to be taken as a rule for practical decisions. Meaning, let's say so you know what? I just realized, you know what? I don't love my translation here. I think I got it from Cincino. We're going to go to the original for 1 second, because I think I didn't realize till now that there's a key word missing. Let's go back to the original. Tana Rabbanan, ein lemeidin halacha lo mipi limud velo mipi ma'aseh. That's what I wanted. Right, I wonder why that doesn't really come through so much in the English here. But the point is, don't get halacha from a story, because that might also be, it's a little bit similar, right? Say, oh, I heard that, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein did X in the street, right? But maybe you shouldn't get halacha that way. Maybe it's not a good way to get halacha. Now, why not? I think that is one way we derive halachot. So if we look at the Rashbam there, right, that's the later part of Baba Batra, where we don't have Rashi anymore. Rashbam is the main commentary. He says, al yikba halacha bakach, so don't fix halakha based on this, because you might make a mistake about the rationale. Now, this is a very interesting thing, which is a much larger conversation, but it's worthy to bring up briefly. I think all of halakha is a back and forth between the following. Like, on the one hand, you want to simplify things for people by giving them the bottom line. On the other hand, if you just give them the bottom line, in a certain sense, they don't really understand the halakha. And certainly, if you don't know the reason, you do not know whether to apply it to a different halacha. So I think if you think about the whole world of halachic literature, there's always this give and take. Should I simplify or should I not simplify? Even think about the following. What does the Shulchan Aruch clearly try to do? Simplify, Rav Yosef Karo doesn't have extensive conversations. Here's the bottom line. But the second that's written, what happens? People like the Magen Avraham and the Taz say, but that's too simple. We need to understand a little bit more what the rationale is, how to apply it. So I'll just give you one brief example. This is really a separate topic that I actually am very fond of, but just for 30 seconds. Let's say I tell you that something you all know, you're not meant to make usage of the Hanukkah lights. You're not supposed to get benefit, right? You shouldn't be reading your favorite novel by the Hanukkah lights. And you have no idea why not. So what would be, now I know, again, you're all too knowledgeable for this. You wouldn't make this mistake. But what could you easily say at that point? Well, here's the rule. Ritual candles in the Jewish system, ritual candles in halacha, you can't get usage from. So now Friday night comes around and you say, hey, stop reading by candlelight. I remember from Hanukkah that it's usher to benefit from ritual candles. But I'm sure a lot of you in the room are thinking right now, that's precisely wrong. Because you have to realize that the purpose of lights on Shabbat are to add oneg, to make it a more pleasant Shabbos meal, right? In fact, you're supposed to light where you're going to eat, we're going to use it. Most of us light where we're going to eat, right? So that's a great example that if I don't know the rationale for, well, the reason for Hanukkah candles is totally different than the reason for Shabbos candles, I wouldn't understand why one you are meant to use and one you are not meant to use. So that's just an example. So I'm just wondering, we could say, well, you have this story. What's the problem? You kind of have a halachic detail, but without any background, without any context, without any halachic discussion. And given that, maybe it will be hard at that point to be able to figure out what the halacha should be based on that. So I'm just going to sum up part one of this year. In part one, we have explored the idea. Oh, actually, you know, there's going to be a fourth part, actually. Let me do a fourth part. One more part and then a fourth rationale. Okay, I was thinking this would be the second part of Shir, but this would be part of the first part. Okay, so there was a famous posek called the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg. And obviously it's a posek, so it's usually halachic issues, but sometimes these kind of things come up. Maybe in a tshuva, somebody wanted to bring an agadic source to make a halachic point. So he's going to rail against it, although I think he's a bit unfair. So let's just look at the first two lines. V'nir l'fiyon adati l'avi hochacha chotacha. I'm going to bring a proof against what you're doing, meaning don't bring in your agadic sources. The amin l'inyan gadol haschar, demala alav hakatuv ki'ilu yoldo. What does it say? If I teach somebody else's kid Torah, it's as if I gave birth to him. That's what the Gemara says. Okay, it's so important. Such a worthy cause to give over education to the next generation. If I teach my neighbor's son, it's as if I'm his dad. So it says, Tzitz Eliezer, Ein rayish nilman mizeh sheyachol lichtov b'shtorot b'no stam. Like, wait, are you going to take that literally? So that means if I'm writing a document or a ketuva, I could write that my neighbor's son is my son, right? Because ki'u yoldo. So he thinks to think like that would be the problem of using agadah for halacha. Agadah is meant to be hyperbole. It's meant to be exaggerated fashion. And when that's true, you couldn't take that into strict halacha. But I think it's really a little bit unfair. I think probably a lot of you are thinking this there. Because there, what does the Gemara say, black and white? It is ki'ilu yoldo. What does the word ki'ilu mean? It is as if. But the whole ki'ilu phrase is about, it's communicating this hyperbole, right? It's not saying that you did give birth to him. It is as if, right? I think you could argue that in that context, such phraseology makes it abundantly clear that we're not talking in a literal fashion. But for the sake of completion, I'd like to put that up as a fourth category. So here we go. Review of part one this year. You could rely on the first Yerushalmi and say that agadic stories are really not meant for legal conclusions. And now we have four ways to do so. Okay, I could do it as the most radical way, as the Gaonim Shmuel Hanagya did it. Agada in general does not have such an authoritative status. I could go with the Rashba and say, what do you mean? Agada is very strong, very authoritative. It's just not meant to be halakhically precise. That's why you're Tosfot, you're missing the boat on your Mordechai and Esther analysis. Okay, then we had my suggestion based on Baba Batra that maybe there's a problem in general in deriving halakha without like a legal conversation. I mean, because I'm just left with a detail, but the detail has no background, has no explanation. That was my Hanukkah candle example. And then fourth, I think that Tzitz Eliezer argument, it's often a language of hyperbole. It's often a language of exaggeration, right? You know, actually, I have another good example. Let's make the tzitzit laser a little bit better. Okay, let's say the Gemara says that if you get angry, it's like you worshipped idols. Now, I am totally with being anti-anger. Anger is one of the most dangerous traits in the world. I'm totally into that. I love that, Gemara. But how literally do you want to take that? Like, let's say we say that you have to give up your life rather than worship avodah zarah. Are we really going to be willing to say, well, you have to give up your life rather than get angry? Okay, as much as many of us will, you know, be anti-anger, I think that seems a bit extreme to say you would have to give up your life. So again, I think what would the Tzitz Eliezer say? We should understand how, you know, agadic language works. Often it has hyperbole, it has exaggerated language, because we're trying to convey just how good or how bad something is. But at that point, it's never meant to be taken literally. Okay? So those are our four approaches to why we wouldn't derive halacha from Agada. Great, we're doing great. Let us go to part two of this year. Okay. Now in part two, first of all, I'd like to show you that, like most things in Judaism, this is not so straightforward. There are people on the other side of this. Maybe we'll just do one source on the other side. And then we'll try to figure out how the other side might address that Yushalmi in the beginning that seemed pretty strong that we don't take agadic stories for our halacha. Okay, so I'm going to look at source 12. I think you'll find this really interesting because it has to do with two really interesting agadot, actually. So if you recall, there's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah with Rabbi Chinan ben Taradion. And he is being tortured to death, right? Some of you probably discussed this on Tisha B'Av. Okay, I imagine maybe in Torah Moshe, someone discussed the Asara who gave Malchut, right? These all these sages who were killed under the Romans. So he is being tortured to death in the sense that he's being burnt, but they're wet sponges that are there to slow down the death. So it'll be slow and painful. So his students say at some point to him, open your mouth and you'll die faster. So, which of course raises an interesting question, which raises the, by the way, Rav Jay, I see you're still filling in the lucky details in the chat there. Okay, excellent. Okay, guys, Rav Jay's doing the job. I'm not going to even look anymore. I'm just going to assume all the lucky details you get in Rav Jay's chat. Okay, so, so that raises the question, is there ever a case where halacha sanctions ending your life earlier? Right. Again, we tend to think that our tradition is very against suicide, which for the most part is true. But like many of these life, maybe there are individual circumstances that are different. So this is pretty remarkable. Look what it says here in this Rabbeinu Tam, based on you'll see which Gemara he bases it on. Okay. It's not as much based on the Chinan ben Taradion Gemara, but he's commenting on the Chinan ben Taradion Gemara, and he's going to base it on a different Gemara. Our Rabbeinu Tam, Deheicha Shireim. What if you're afraid? Pen yavirum ovde kochavim la'avera. Ah, in some ways, I don't mean to say this in a callous way, but martyrdom's easy, right? The guy says to me, sleep with your sister, I'll shoot you. And I say, I refuse, and he shoots me, and it's over. But what if he's going to torture me till I do the wrong thing? Kagon al yidei yisurim, right? That's much trickier, right? I don't have this, as it were, quick end, but I'm going to be suffering torture. And what if the victim knows I'm not going to be able to withstand it? I can't withstand 5 days of torture. Now, this is remarkable. Look what Tosafot says. Azu mitzuveh l'chabel ba'atzmo. You actually are commanded to hurt yourself. Meaning Tosafot seems to think there is a scenario where even suicide is justified. Meaning if it's just I'll be shot, so okay, so I should let the ruffian shoot me. But if I know I'll be tortured into the sin and I won't be able to avoid it, so the mathematical equation changes. Now, how does Tosafot know that, though? Look at this. Ki ahi de gitin, because there's an agadah in gitin. Remember, we mentioned that the churban bayit gemara, all that section gitin, from nun hei through nun chet. Look what he says. Some of you probably know the story. Gabi yeladim shenishbu lekalon. It's a powerful story, right? Unfortunately, Jewish boys and girls, young kids, were captured by the Romans. And apparently they were taken, you know, be sold, as prostitutes. That's why they were being taken. And the kids decided to throw themselves into the ocean during the boat ride, right? That rather than be forced into such a life, we could throw ourselves in. And what is Tosafot assuming? A, that that's positive, which I think in the Gemara it's clear. The Gemara is praising those kids. But B, oh, wait, we now learned a new halacha. if those kids were allowed, or even it's meritorious for them to kill themselves rather than to be forced into a lifetime of sin. So apparently that's okay. There is one scenario where you can justify a suicide. Now, clearly, wait, we could all say, Tosfot, what about everything we said before here? Tosfot, didn't you see that Yerushalmi? Right? Didn't you see that Yerushalmi says you shouldn't, in fact, derive halachic details from stories? So apparently, like everything else, life's more complicated. Now, either we could say it's a debate, or what if Tosfot will have us go back and maybe revisit that first Gemara, that first Yerushalmi? So now we get to a really, really interesting source. You know, I tried to cut it down as much as possible, but it still ended up being the longest source. Okay, so some of you have been to Prague. So if you've been to Prague, by the way, I'm not being paid here to do like, you know, from vacation recommendations, but I highly recommend Prague, actually. It'll just say four good things about it. It's interesting Jewishly. It's interesting general history. There are kosher restaurants and everything's close together. So it is excellent for a good kosher vacation. Okay, so in Prague, there are a couple of Jewish cemeteries. And you're all probably familiar with the famous one that has where the Maral is buried. I'll just mention, if someone likes to go to cemeteries on vacations, there are two other Jewish cemeteries in Prague. They're actually not in the center of the city. There you would have to take a train. One of them is where the Note of Yehuda is buried. We'll come back to him in a second. And just I can't resist, one of them is where Kafka's buried. So here, this is not really relevant to show. I apologize, but it's such a good story. I have to tell it. So my wife and I are in Prague on a vacation. And they ask help in making a minyan because somebody passed away, making a minyan at the cemetery. So I figured we're there for 4 days. We'll do a nice thing. My wife and I figured, I should say. So we went. I was the 10th Jew. So it did work. Okay. And it ended up being the cemetery where Kafka's buried. So after the ceremony is over, my wife and I go to Kafka's grave. And it was amazing. His grave looks like anybody else's grave. There's nothing special about it. And it says something like Po Nikbar, I know Usher Anshul Kafka, right? That's all it says. So I thought it was very interesting. It was like, you know, death is the great equalizer, that Kafka's grave looks no different than the other Jewish person's grave. Okay, that being said, so Yechezkel Landau was the chief rabbi of Prague. He wrote a lot of important svarim. And one of them is a collection of tshuvot called the Nodab Yehuda. Okay, and he has a very interesting discussion there where I think his correspondent didn't understand what he wanted to say. So let's just look at that. I'm going to jump around. We're not going to read the whole thing. Don't worry. But let's look at the beginning of source six. Almasha katati l'roma lato. So here's what I wrote to you. She'ein darki l'hashiv b'divrei agada. In my halachic tshuvot, I don't really get involved so much in agadic material. Now, I think the fellow misunderstood him. What did my correspondent do in his letter, says Rav Landau? The Harich Lavi Kamigdolim Shechibru B'divrei Haggadah. He says, wait, you don't care about Haggadah? Look at all these famous people that wrote about Haggadah. Let's say the Marsha wrote about Haggadah. The Maral wrote about Haggadah. Like, people care about Haggadah. So Rav Yechezkel Landau says to him, and this really highlights, by the way, the difference between the Rashba and Rav Shmuel HaNugget, that you misunderstood me. Like, when I said, Ein Darki Lashid B'Devre Haggadah, I wasn't, like, God forbid, saying Haggadah is silly. Agadah doesn't matter, right? I was saying something else. So he says on the third line, V'chidivri Chazal Tzrichim Shevach, you think I need to praise Chazal? I love Agadah. I was not saying Agadah is of a lower quality. But what was I saying? So he says, okay, here we go. All I was saying is that, okay, I'm skipping a little bit, but he says Agadah is very difficult. And I don't use it in halachic reasoning. Okay, so I think this really highlights the Rashba's position. If I say I don't use Agadah for halachic reasoning, I'm certainly not necessarily saying that Agadah is a lower level. It's just not meant for halacha. But now comes the most interesting part. Okay, and it sounds like, here, I'm going to highlight. It sounds like even this was debated between his correspondent and Rav Landau. So look what the correspondent argued. So remember, let's all remember the first quote. What was the first quote? Don't derive halacha from Agadot or from Tosefta. Valzen nishan malato. That's what you're relying on. Lomar ki hechi demin ha-Tosefto nidbar b'divrei ha-poskim. And he really makes the argument I raised before, which it wasn't mine. I got it from here. She b'makom she'ein b'gemara stira l'divrei ha-Tosefta. What if there's no Talmud Bavli that contradicts the Tosefta? L'meida mimenu, we will learn it, right? Tosefta is a valid halachic source. It's just not as authoritative as the Talmud Bavli. So the correspondent of Rav Landau, really, there's a good rule for life. You could all become famous if you become have a give and take with some great halachic decisor, because then you always have, you know, your words get recorded also. So the other fellow's argument was that it's parallel. So what does that mean? When it says don't derive halacha from Agadah, it's the same as don't derive halacha from Tosefta. Namely, Bavli has higher status. So if there's ever a conflict, Talmud Bavli beats Tosefta, Mishnah beats Tosefta. But if there is no conflict and there's a new case, Tosefta wins. So says the correspondent of Rav Landau. So I make the same argument here, right? Anytime there's a story that's against the halacha, indeed, I can ignore it. But if there's a story that covers ground not addressed by halacha, it would win. Kevin, good with that? So, and he wants to infer that from the juxtaposition of Agada and Tosefta. And now the Noti Bidu is going to make a comeback. And I've really been curious about this for years. I have to admit, we have a very bright group here. Maybe someone will help me out, because I'm not sure who's right about this. Okay, and maybe if any of you have any ideas, actually, I'm very excited to see if someone's, sometimes you give a shiur endlessly to find out who has the answer to your question. So look at the Noti Bidu says. I'm going to point to where I am. The Amna Mani Yomer, the Avda Yushalmi Kalalinu Yachad, even though the Yushalmi indeed put these sources next to each other, namely, it mentioned Agadah right next to Tosefta, Mikomakom La Bechada Machta Machtinu, that doesn't mean they're the same. Basically, he's saying two things could appear on the same list and yet play out quite differently. Uma inyan hamidrash etzel ha-tosefta. How can I really compare midrashic material, agadic material, with the tosefta? Da ha-tosefta ikra la-halachot. That's the whole point of the tosefta. It is halachic material. Ulezeh ya-tchilat kavanat mechabram b'mchir Rav Oshia. Heime Yestua, right? Those two scholars are associated with the collection of the Tosefta, Rabbi Chaim Rabbi Shaya. V'chom gamatam l'dini Torah. That was the whole purpose. They weren't telling stories. They were trying to tell you how the halacha plays out. V'lechem b'makom shein stira. But if you're right, therefore, there's no contradiction. Somchim ala Tosefta, we rely on it. Avala midrashim v'agado, ikar kavaratam al ha-musar. Right? They're more about ethical messages. They're more about religious ideas. They are not about halachic details. But here, I'm just going to sum up the debate where I'm really not sure who's right. Meaning, what if we have a list where two things are placed together? So you might say, well, if they're placed together, so then they should be the same, right? That's why they're placed together. But what everyone says, no, but if I look at their individual characters, they're so different. See, that's exactly the debate here between Rav Landau and his correspondent, right? The correspondent says, look what it says in Yushalmi. Don't derive halacha from Agadah or from Tosefta, given that we would, in certain our circumstances, derive halacha from Tosefta. So Agadah is the same thing. So he has a good inference in that Yushalmi that, in fact, we can get halacha from Agadah in certain circumstances. Whereas Rav Landau says, no, you can't do that. Look at the specifics of the thing. I don't care that Tosefta and Agadah appeared in the same list. At the end of the day, Tosefta is a clearly halachic text, and Agadah is not meant to be a halachic text. And even on the same list, I play them out differently, and Tosefta has legal validity in certain circumstances, Agadah does not. Okay, so again, I'm open to anyone suggesting, literarily, does the correspondent have a stronger answer, a stronger position? Does Rav Landau have a stronger position? But be that as it may, I think we've opened up some interesting things here about how you could go both ways, right? Again, as I said, always be careful with a quick reading of one source. It's true that first source in the Yushalmi seemed to indicate we don't get halacha from Agadah. We could already see why, it's much more complicated, given the comparison to Tosefta. Maybe there are scenarios where we can derive. Okay? This finishes part two. Okay, so we'll get to the part three, which is the concluding part. What do we know so far? We saw the position that we don't derive halacha from Agadah. We suggested a number of possible reasons why that might be. We then saw that some Rishonim do, in fact, use Agadah to derive halacha, right? Here in a very dramatic way, right? Maybe that's the source of a case where you're allowed to commit suicide. That's pretty dramatic. Okay, so That would be a case where you can. And we saw in the Nota Behuda versus correspondent a little bit of a give and take how to read that Yushalmi. Okay? Are we good with that? Okay, wonderful. Let us now go on to the last part of the share. Okay. So we're going to see again two very interesting poskim. Okay. And their back and forth, I think, is quite fascinating. Okay. So again, we're back in Rav Waldenberg. And Rav Waldenberg is going to argue with Rav Ovadia Yosef. And I feel like I have to give it could be, you know it, or maybe Mark Shapiro or somebody else has already given Torah Motion Shiur on Rav Ovadia Yosef. I'm not sure. But Rav J, has Mark spoken about Rav Ovadia?
A long time ago, like probably 12, 13 years ago, before anybody heard of COVID, it was very tricky. Okay, he gave a few classes in Rav Ovadia Yosef. But so he has not done the Tzitz Eliezer yet, as far as I know, as far as I can tell. But okay, thank you.
So I'll just mention very briefly, because people should be aware, Rav Ovadia Yosef is really a significant personality in Israeli history. Because in the early years of the state, and this is very important, even for understanding what's happening today, right? Svardim felt very much that their culture wasn't respected. And I would say something very interesting, that was true both in the secular world and the religious world. Meaning in the secular world, there was a sense that all the significant politicians are Ashkenazi, you know, Ben-Gurion and Levi Eshkol and Moshe Dayan, etc. And the Svardim are not respected. But guess what? If I move to the Beit Midrash, the Svardim had the same experience. Right? What would the Ashkenazim say? Who are the real Talmidei Chachamim? You know, the Chazon Ish, the Brisker Rav, right? All Ashkenazim. So in many ways, Rav Ovadia Yosef is the Sephardi hero on both levels. Meaning, Rav Ovadia Yosef was obviously a tremendous Talmud Chacham. So it became hard to argue that Ashkenazi rabbis have a monopoly on all the great scholars. So he was a tremendous symbol for Sephardi religious Jewry. But even on a political level, right, Rav Ovadia is involved in the founding of Shas. When Sephardim first, as it were, started to express their political muscle. You know, there are enough Sephardim in the country that often Shas was able to decide which party would be in government. So you have Rav Ovadia. It's really remarkable. You have one person who like puts, restores Sephardic glory, Sephardic pride, both in the Beit Midrash and in the political arena. And I'll give you an amazing illustration of this. Okay. I think it's really an amazing illustration. Okay. It's really interesting to walk around Israel during an election season and look at the signs. So let me say it this way. When I look at the Ashkenazi Haredi parties, there are no signs featuring the Brisker Rav and the Chazon Ish, right? They're not there, right? If you're going to have signs of great rabbis, it'll be a great rabbi who's alive today who is endorsing that you should go vote for the Haredi Ashkenazi party. But if I look, okay, those of you who live in Israel will back me up on this, right? If I look at the Shah signs, who is still there? Rav Ovadia is still there every election. Okay. It is not relevant who the current Sephardi rabbis are, right? Why should you vote for Shas? Because Rav Ovadia is smiling at you. There you go. So I think that shows you what a powerful figure Rav Ovadia is in contemporary Sephardi culture. And I think given the background of the state of Israel, I think we should really appreciate what that means. Okay. Great. So now that we gave a little background, let us now see the case they're debating, and we'll see something very interesting about how Agadah plays in. So this is really fascinating. Okay, the question was raised, what is Halacha's position on plastic surgery? Now, why would there be a question? So I think we could all realize, like most surgeries that we know of in this world are surgeries because someone really has a real illness. Someone has a real problem. And then we're not going to wonder, should we do a surgery usually? Because, you know, the surgery could be life-saving, could be limb-saving, right? So most surgeries don't really lend themselves to much halakhic, well, I shouldn't say that, but for the most part, we don't have to deal with this halakhic question. But one could argue if there's a certain risk, even a minuscule risk in every surgery, and here it's really just aesthetic, right? It's just that the person, I don't know, thinks that they have too big a nose, whatever the case may be. So should we allow it? Maybe we should say that, you know, this is not something we value like saving a arm. And therefore, like you don't really have a right to undergo the health risk for the sake of this and doing the surgery. So I think you're all going to find this really interesting, both per se and when we take it back to the question of Agadah. Okay, so let's start, because we're going to see that Rav Waldenberg and Rav Ovadia were not on the same team here. So let's look at source 14. And here I have to admit, I was a little bit uncomfortable Rav Waldenberg is really pretty negative. Okay, look what he does here. V'acht meguchachu. It is almost like it's a joke. What's a joke? Again, he's going to be the anti-voice. Again, just to get you ahead of time, Rav Avi is going to say it's okay, and Rav Waldenberg is going to argue it's not okay. But what does he think is a joke? Lavo lahatzia. Lahatir nituach kazeh. Okay, now, nituach is the modern Hebrew word for a surgery, right? You're cutting something up. Is lunateach. So he says it's a joke to allow this surgery. Now, hang on. He doesn't mean that the position's a joke, but he says based on the following. What would make it a joke? Linashim for women. Begivav kolod alpi midrashim shonim. What if you gather together, like you know your midrash. So you go through Medrash Rabbah, you go through Yalkut Shimoni. What do you collect? Hamahalim hayofi linashim. That praise female beauty. Now again, it's not our topic. I'm not going to get into female beauty versus male looks. If everyone's okay with that, we're leaving that out. Okay, but the point is, there are midrashim about beauty that value beauty. You seem to think of it as something that is not irrelevant. Ah, now apparently, what did someone want to say? Ah, I'll use that to factor in to my halachic discussion here, right? Quite fascinating, right? Right. If you say there are no Jewish sources in favor of beauty, what if we just view beauty as a danger and a bad thing? Right, and materialism. So then what right would I have to do such a surgery? So apparently somebody wrote, maybe even Rav Ovadia, that no, we have sources that praise beauty. So it can be something of significance. And therefore, that might be reason to allow the surgery. But look how Rav Waldenberg is dismissive of this argument. He says, V'ein kedai afilu l'hashiv al zeh. It's not even worth answering. V'ein l'kazot makom b'halacha klal. Look what he says. This kind of arguing has no place in halacha. Why not? So I think what he's getting at as follows. Again, I just want to translate the last line. He's saying this is even less convincing than the cases we had before. And I think what he means is as follows. In the cases we had before, the Gemara did make a legal statement. It just made a legal statement in the Gadic context. Like, let's think about the Mordechai and Esther scenario. What did the Gemara Megillah pretty clearly convey? If Esther willingly goes to Achashverosh, she will now be usher to Mordechai. That's what it seems to convey. So we could say, like the Rashba, that that was not a source that was interested in legal precision. But that's not the point. It is making a legal statement. It clearly is making a legal statement. However, says Rav Waldenberg, but if you just have midrash that beauty is a good thing, let's say it's a three great things that, you know, I don't know, women have wisdom, beauty, and whatever the third is. But that's not a halachic statement, even in context, right? Even in its agadic midrashic world, it is not saying, therefore, the law is like follows. The halacha is X or Y. So at that point, says Rav Waldenberg, it's a non-starter. So that's why I think he's even more negative here. He says, even by the context of agadic sources, there's even less reason to bring in a generic phrase for beauty. And then it's pretty obvious what he's going to do at the end, although this is more poetic. He says, if already you're going to do that, look at his closing line. What's he going to quote, of course? It's just a no-brainer. Why didn't you go to Sefer Mishlei? You want to quote non-halachic sources? What does it say in Mishlei? You know, beauty is just vanity. Being a God-fearing woman, that's where it's at. And you'll be against beauty. There we go. Okay, I've got Rav Waldenberg down. So Rav Waldenberg is pretty against this kind of usage of Agada. And what I think is very interesting is that he thinks this is even lesser than the cases we've been discussing till now. Okay, but I would like to rescue this a little bit. And we're going to rely on Rav Ovadia to do the job. Okay. Oh, just so people should know, sorry, one last interesting about Rav Ovadia. Many of you might be fascinated by him. So he has two books of Tshuvot. One is called Yabia Omer. One is called Yechav Adat. I'll just give one piece of information and one warning. Okay, Rav Ovadia's greatness was in the sheer amount of sources he remembered. So therefore, Yabia Omer's Tshuvot are very long. Because he's not going to quote one person who says something. Say, and here are the following 17 people who agree with him. Okay, so for the faint of heart, I'm not sure I would recommend the Yabia Omer. That's a long, but this is fascinating, though. Those who really want to encounter Rav Ovadia but have less time, So the other set of tshuvot, Yechavedat, actually began as a radio show. Okay, Rav Ovadia used to be on the radio and you get asked questions. And I guess in a radio show, even Rav Ovadia had to hold himself in a little bit. He could not, you know, give, and here are my 30 pages answer to your question. So again, so you have Yechavedat, which is shorter tshuvot, because that was based on his radio show, and Yabia Omer, which is much longer tshuvot. So this is from Yabia Omer, but luckily I picked out the key lines. So he says, okay, Gam Meshekatav, Shal Kagonze Amru, Ein Lemeidin Min Agadot. Ah, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that we have that Yushalmi. The Yushalmi says that we can't learn halacha from Agada. Says Rav Ovadia, Ze'eno. Okay, this is not true. Now, first, he's going to quote an idea we've already said, but I would like to expand it. But let's start with the idea we already said. Shiyadua shezeu davka ba'agada shecholeket al ha-Talmud shalanu. That's only, he goes back to that position we saw before, right? The position of the note of Yehuda's correspondent. That's only if the halacha argues, sorry, the Agada argues with the Talmud. Indeed, a story can't overcome a halachic statement. Ah, but halav hachi, if that's not the case, lemeidim, we do indeed derive halacha from Agada. But I want to go a step further. Okay, so what did Rav Ovadia say so far? Again, a position we know already, then maybe it is not so categorical, not such a comprehensive rule that we can't ever derive halachot from Agadic stories. And maybe their case we can. Okay, but I'd like to go a step further because I think it really points to the Tzitz Eliezer's critique, and I would like to respond to it. We'll defend Rav Ovadia a little bit. What did Tzitz Eliezer say? That this is even less. Why is this even less? Because if I say beauty matters, beauty could be something of significance, right? I'm not making a halachic statement. But here we go. Here's the problem. And not the problem. Here's the solution, I actually would say. It is not true that halachic decisions can be divorced from our value judgments, from our values. Very often when I'm sure, you know, this Rav Jay has to deal with this all the time and he's asked halachic questions, like how far should I go to be lenient? So how far should I go to be lenient? Isn't that a very strong function of how much do I view this as a real need or not? If I view it as a real need, as a real value, I will try harder to find lenient positions. If I don't view it as a real need, so then I will not try so hard. So I think this comes up all the time. And it's, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think this is the way halacha should work. And you could have different groups that will come to different psakim based on their hashkafa. You can, it's not really true that you can make a total break between hashkafa and halacha. I mean, I'll give you a very simple example. Okay. Yeah. I'm trying to think which example to go with here. Yeah. Why not? Let's say I'm trying to figure out whether women can say Kaddish, right? And let's say for the sake of argument that halachic sources could go both ways. So certainly if my worldview is that I think women should be allowed to have as much religious expression as possible, right? Again, I still have halachic boundaries, but I'd like to give them more expression, especially if it comes to commemorating a beloved relative. So I'm looking for the arguments and sources that allow women to say Kaddish. Right. And that's why I think in a lot of our modern Orthodox communities, women say Kaddish. If I'm in a more Haredi community, and I'm not even saying this to be negative, I just sort of understand this point, right? Where that's less of an issue, right? They don't come with this, oh, really hashkafically, we should give women more opportunities as long as it's not clearly asur, right? They're not thinking in those terms. So they are not necessarily looking for those sources. But I think that really highlights the fact. And I think it's a good thing, right? Surely halacha is not just this dry mechanical system. It is a system that responds to value judgments. And if I make a certain value judgment, that'll influence a psak and others won't. Now, I admit sometimes I'm not saying every halachic question is like this. It could be, I don't know, if I'm deciding, I don't know, how to tie my shoes on Shabbos, what's a mutter not, what's an usher not. Maybe grand hashkafic principles are not so relevant. Maybe the modern Orthodox posek and the Haredi posek will give the same answer to how to tie your shoes on Shabbos or how to make tea on Shabbos. But I think there are cases where the hashkafa really does matter. So now let's go back here. I really like to defend Rav Ovadia, right? I'm trying to figure out if I should allow plastic surgery. And one can make the argument, no, plastic, you know, every surgery has some modicum of danger. And we don't really, you know, value so much the need to be a little prettier. And therefore, we should answer it. But wait, that was an assumption, though, right? That assumed that our tradition doesn't place such value on looks, or maybe to be even stronger, or on how a person feels about their looks. Maybe that's the way to say it. And what if I say, hashkafically, that I think it's really important? Again, I'm not taking a position on this, but what if I say, you know, it could do have really impact on somebody's self-esteem, and therefore I do value it. I do place some kind of value on the aesthetics of appearance. So at that point, it's not crazy what Rav Adya is doing. So again, even though Rav Waldenberg said, let's go through the double argument, and then we'll wrap up the whole shiur, and I'll take closing comments. The double argument, I think, between Rav Waldenberg and Rav Ovadia. Rav Waldenberg in general seems to be into the rule, ein lemeidin min ha'agadot. Don't derive halakha from agadic stories. And by the way, notice the earlier quote, Rav Waldenberg did the same thing. Now, I admit, I'm not an expert in Rav Waldenberg, but it would be interesting if that's like a running theme, that he has a negativity towards trying to derive halakha from agada. What did Rav Ovadia say? The comeback, we know. Not everybody thinks this is a universal rule. Some people think that if there's no contradiction from Mishnah Gemara, Talmud Bavli, so you're fine. You can derive. And that was the comparison to the Tosefta and the original Yerushalm. Fine. That's easy. But let's go to the second part. I think the second part's even more interesting. Rav Waldenberg said, Rav Ovadia, this is even worse. Because at least in the Esther story, it was a clear halachic statement, right? Once they're together willingly, they can no longer be husband and wife. But in this case, it's just a generic phrase of beauty. So how could I ever possibly plug that into the halachic system? So I hope Rav Ovadia would agree with me, but I think I've given an answer that it's not true that larger values have no role in the halachic system. So even if it wasn't a halachic statement, it's a rabbinic value judgment. So if there are no rabbinic value judgments that are in praise of beauty, so then it'll be very hard to justify plastic surgery. But the second I say, wait, there are multiple rabbinic statements in favor of beauty. So that point, that gets weight on the halachic scale. Okay, we just do a 1 minute summary and I'll take closing questions. But as usual, you guys are quite enjoyable to learn with. Okay, we saw a statement that says you can't derive halacha from Agadah. We explored various reasons why. We again have the radical of Shmuel Hanagid, who says that Agadah in general is not so authoritative. That's a pretty strong statement. We had the Rashba who says Agadah is really authoritative. It's just, but not for halacha. That's not its point. Okay, that we saw. Then we had, I wanted to suggest maybe lacking the rationale, we can't really work with it. And we also had the Tzitz Eliezer who said it often talks in hyperbole. It talks in the language of Ki'ilu. And since it's the language of Ki'ilu, you can't use it halachically, which I tried to counter. Yeah, but then we saw that some Rishonim do in fact derive halacha from it. Right? Tosfot says the source for a permitted suicide when you're going to be tortured into sin is an agadah in Gittin. So apparently it's not at all universal that you can't derive halacha from agadah. And then we had this fascinating, we really had two great Achronish debates today. Noda Behuda versus correspondent and Rav Ovadia versus Rav Waldenberg. So what did Noda Behuda's correspondent say? He said, it's just like the Tosefta. That's the list, which means it does have a halachic role to play. And Rav Landau from Prague said, nothing doing. I don't care that it's the same list as the Tosefta. It's not the same kind of thing. Tosefta is a legal text and the Agada is not. Therefore, Agada does not have a role to play in halacha. Okay, and then we finally got to plastic surgery, where we saw that Rav Waldenberg, once again, just like he said in the Ki'ilu source, he's against the halacha of Agadah, and he thought that the case of beauty is even worse. And we, I think, did a good job of defending Rav Ovadia, that A, some people think you can derive halacha from Agadah, and B, larger value judgments really, in many cases, are part, in fact, of the halachic system. Okay. This brings our third cheer to a close. Let me see if there's anything interesting in the chat, and maybe we'll also... look, I'll say it this way, in terms of the comments. Someone asked about if there's a rabbinic way, there's a halachic way. I think that's a bit overstated, but I would say there's always a balancing, right? How great is the need, and how serious is the halachic prohibition you're trying to deal with? Okay, so I would say it that way, and at that point, it doesn't mean that you'll always win, but when there's flexibility, right, then the rabbinic will could be pretty influential. So I would tone it down a bit. Maybe not a bit. I would tone it down, but it has truth on a toned down level. Okay. Would anybody else like to raise a comment or question?
There is a question in the chat box. I don't know if you want to address it. And actually, I can say now, we haven't finalized it yet, but please God, Dr. Benny Gesundheit is going to give a whole series on this. But that's for here, a special private announcement that's not finalized, asking the differences between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi on this issue of Agadah.
Oh, wow.
If you look in chat box, but I'll just point, I think that's
Wait, Rev J, Bavli Yerushalmi in general, or specifically Agadah and Bavli Yerushalmi?
I'm assuming, Naomi, I'm assuming you mean on this particular issue, Agadah. Benny is hopefully going to give a series on, in general, the difference
between
Bavli and Yerushalmi. Nice. But I spoke to him, that, whatever, that's just an aside. You answer this question.
The truth is, I'm going to do some research and get back to you next week. It, even though I'm a big lover of Agadah, I don't really have a handle on the exact difference between Bavli Agadah versus Yerushalmi Agadah. And it's good. It's good you asked me that question. It's something, it's a hole in my education that I should fill. So I will hopefully have some information next week.
I believe that Rabbi Lord Jacobovitz wrote somewhere that halachic decisions are obviously sociologically influenced, which is somewhat what you're saying also.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree. Okay, someone asked about Ashkenazi versus Sephardi postgame. Was that question? That's the question I just saw. Let's just look for a second. Okay, look, it's hard to answer. Look, obviously, there is a tendency for Ashkenazim to follow Ashkenazi postgame and for Sephardim to follow Sephardi postgame. For sure, that's true. I just think that, you know, Psak is much more complicated. I'll give you two reasons why it's much more complicated. One is, let's say I'm following Sephardi postgame. That doesn't mean I've solved my problem. Like, what if Rav Vadya Yosef argues with the Ben Ish Chai? Some of you may, like, we Ashkenazim, sorry, I should say we Ashkenazim, I have no idea how many Sephardim are in this chat, but fine. Those of us who are Ashkenazim, right, might not be aware of the diversity of Sephardic positions, right? The Ben Ish Chai was the Baghdadi's halachic hero, not Rav Ovadia. And Rav Vadya often disagreed with the Ben Ish Chai. So even if I'm Sephardic, I might say, wait, am I in Rav Ovadia's camp or am I in the Ben Ish Chai's camp? Right. And since I'm Ashkenazi, I might say, am I more a follower of Moshe Feinstein or Rav Soloveitchik? So even that's complicated. And I'll even go a step further. Okay. And this is really a topic for another time. Some of you might think that Ashkenazim will always follow the Ramah and Sephardim will always follow Rav Yosef Karo. That is certainly true the overwhelming majority of the time, but I've been collecting examples where it's not true. Okay. So you should know that there are select examples where that's not the way halacha played out. It's not always true that Ashkenazim follow the Ramah and Sephardim follow Yosef Karo. Okay. Anybody else?
Probably the best example of that is by Hanukkah, no?
Yes, for sure.
By Hanukkah candles, whether everybody lights or one person, where Ashkenazim follow the Rambam and Sephardim follow Tosfot.
So Rav Jay is correct. He's absolutely right. The most famous example is how Hanukkah lighting works. And it's reversed. But I'll just point out, this is much less well-known. It's not the only example. Okay, I'm not going to do it now, but you should know that it's not the only time in halacha that things are carry out in a surprising way.
Okay, anybody else have any questions?
Hey, Yitzi, I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Talking about the Shabbos candles, I think Rav Benny Lau was talking about this, but I'm not sure. But I heard it recently. We light two Shabbos candles because one of them is not to be used. So we light two because one of them acts as the shamash. But why is the first candle being lit for Shabbos? It's not this, it's not the Oneg Shabbos. It's something else, which I can't remember right now, but there's something about.
Okay. So let me say two things. We'll close it up. By the way, I can't distrust Ruthie because I know she's my relative. So I have to believe that she's quoting Rav Benny accurately. Okay. But, I do have two. Okay. I'll say two things because I'm not sure. Now you got me really curious. Shabbos candles accomplishes three goals. Although I don't know if this is what you mean. It is Oneg Shabbos. It helps you enjoy Shabbat. It is Kavod Shabbat. It helps bring honor to the atmosphere. And we say that it promotes shalom bayit. It also promotes a good feeling in the house. So it is true that you think, oh, it's just a simple thing, lighting Shabbos candles. There's three different halachic values that you're accomplishing. Again, Oneg Shabbat, Kavod Shabbat, and shalom bayit. However, I'm a little confused about this Shamus parallel because that would seem to indicate that there's one element that's not meant to be enjoyed. Which I've never, I mean, all I've heard my entire life is that two candles are because of Zachar v'Shamar. Not that there's any kind of like Isser Hishtamshud, a problem of usage that I'm overcoming with the second candle. So I'd love to know where Rav Benny got that from. Okay. I'm not saying it can't be right. Just I've never heard that idea before. Rav Jay, you have any suggestions?
Yeah. So I went to look. I pulled out the wrong volume. I seem to remember something that Danny Sperber has in Minhagei Yisrael explaining something in Germany. It got dark, very light. They used to eat outside in the second candle. I have to look up the article. Of course, this phenomenal work, Minhagei Yisrael. I thought it might be in volume two, but I see it's not. I'll have to look up. And please, God, if you remind me before next week, or I can send you. I know, I'm pretty sure Benny Lau discusses Ner Shel Kavod or something, but I don't know. There must be more material, but thank you.
Okay, great. So I think we're going to wrap up here. I'll just say one thing. This is good now because two of us have homework for next week. I was upset it was only going to be me. I have to look up the Bava Yerushalmi, but now Reb Jay has to deal with Ruthie's question. Okay? Excellent.
Okay, thank you very much. Look, for next week is the contribution of the academic world, the relationship between the academy and the Beit Midrash. Always one, I think, unfortunately, fraught with tension often, but whatever, that we'll discuss next week. Okay, tomorrow, Rav Avia Tabori, another neighbor of Rabbi Blau and Alon Shvit, who is right now in Camp Stone. So he'll be giving the Parsha Shir tomorrow at 8:30. Then, of course, please God, I'll be giving my Shir in the Siddur at 9:30. And then Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday at 11:15. And as I sort of alluded to, although, you know, with Dr. Benny, we're working on the ELO program, still putting on some touches, still open to ideas and suggestions. And like I say, always looking for interesting speakers. So Baruch Hashem, we have many, but we always like to expand our roster. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful day and look forward to learning with you in the near future. And always, as always, invite a friend. And thank you very much. And thank you. Somebody pointed out, I couldn't find it right away so quickly at the end, that Shira Mervis also gave a talk on Rav Avadi Yosef when she gave her series on Sephardic Poskim. So if you go through the Torah Motion website, our archives, we have well over 2,000 talks you can listen to. We didn't record anything we did on Shabbos. We didn't rely on any Shabbos goyim. Otherwise, we'd have 5,000. But Nunu, what can we do? Anyway, so you can type in Rav Avadi Yosef and get all the stuff. But Mark gave 5 talks. I see 2 and then 3. And Shira Mervis, and I see different things, but all kinds of interesting stuff. Okay, have a wonderful day, everybody, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.